From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Morning, everyone. Listen, audience. My name is William Smith. I'm the president of New York Metro Postal Union right here in the city of New York. Here today, the guests on Democracy Now! Program talk about Operation TIPS, the reason why I'm here to speak against that. Postal workers, in general, it's hard to process mail, not to do law enforcement work.
U.S. postal workers say no to Operation TIPS, the Justice Department's citizen spy network. Also, a look at the Hollywood hacking bill that gives corporations the right to hack into personal computers. And finally, new satellite images show a U.S. military base in Qatar as Saudi Arabia is accused of being an enemy of the U.S. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Guerrillas struck an Afghan army base today in southern Kabul, and 15 people were killed. It was the most serious battle in the capital in months and comes just a day after U.S. troops killed four men who reportedly opened fire on them 90 miles to the northeast. And this news from Kashmir, the chief minister of Indian Kashmir has called for the destruction of guerrilla training camps in Pakistan. His comments come after guerrillas on Tuesday killed nine Hindu pilgrims on an annual religious pilgrimage in the region. The United Nations General Assembly has demanded an immediate Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian towns and cities and an end to violence against civilians on both sides of the Middle East conflict. Israeli forces killed at least two Palestinian gunmen near Jenin and another in Gaza. And Israel's Supreme Court has given the army the right to blow up the homes of dozens of families related to suicide bombers. Earlier today, hundreds of Palestinians were joined by international solidarity activists in the village of Hawara, just outside Nablus. Over a dozen people were arrested, including International Solidarity Movement co-founder Adam Shapiro. Waji Ode is with us now, mayor of Hawara, the town outside Nablus.
This town has been under curfew since the last 22 months, since the beginning of the uprising, partially and fully. At the beginning of the uprising, they burned the main mosque. Settlers came and burned the main mosque of the town. About 50 people in this town injured and two killed in this uprising. That was because of the settlers moving on the main road. Today there was a demonstration to lift siege and closure on Nablus city, because city of Nablus been under siege and closure for the last 2 weeks. They need their food and medicine. To send a message to the free world that we want you to move, people and government, to find a solution to the Palestinian issue. It is enough. We live in jeopardized situations where we are unable to move inside this town. Roads are closed. Sick people are unable to reach to the hospitals because of the closure of towns and roads. I hope the government of America particularly move quickly to find a political solution to this issue, where we could have a 24% of the whole Palestine and establish a Palestinian state on it. Also, the Israeli people will live in peace when we get our rights as a Palestinian, live like the other people in the whole world.
Waji Ode, mayor of Hawara, the town outside Nablus, where over a dozen people were just arrested. The U.S. Justice Department Tuesday defied a federal judge's order to produce documents to back its contention that a U.S. citizen captured in Afghanistan is a so-called enemy combatant and is therefore not entitled to constitutional protections. Government lawyers said the Constitution's separation of powers clause gives the executive branch the authority to make that determination. The government's action sets the stage for a constitutional confrontation tomorrow between executive and judicial branches. President Bush has signed a bill in Washington giving him the sweeping authority to negotiate international trade agreements without input from Congress. Less than 20 minutes after signing, he left for a month-long so-called working vacation at his 1,600-acre ranch in Crawford, Texas. In Argentina, thousands of people marched to protest the U.S. Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill's visit. Protesters burnt a picture of O'Neill with the caption, "Get out O'Neill and IMF." O'Neill is touring Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina. President Bush bypassed the vacationing Senate and installed Cheryl Halpern on the board of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Halpern is vice chair of the Republican Jewish Coalition, a major Republican fundraiser, and serves on the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which is responsible for spreading U.S. government propaganda around the world through government broadcasts, including Voice of America. Bush also installed Thomas Dorr as Undersecretary of Agriculture for Rural Development. Dorr failed to win the endorsement of the Senate Agriculture Committee last week. His business improperly collected thousands of dollars in federal farm subsidies in the 1990s. He's also been accused of making racially offensive remarks and was a contributor to Bush's presidential campaign. And here in New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced the city's plans for the anniversary of September 11th. World leaders will light an eternal flame. New York Governor George Pataki will read the Gettysburg Address, and the former mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, will lead a reading of the names of the more than 2,800 victims. Mayor Bloomberg also announced the city will sponsor candlelight vigils around the city. He asked New Yorkers to reflect and listen to music from the city's orchestras. But a peace coalition, including Peaceful Tomorrows, an organization of people who lost loved ones on September 11th, has not been granted a permit to hold its own vigil on that day. Many of these families have spoken out against the bombing of Afghanistan. Organizers say they were told the city was not granting any permits for unofficial vigils or remembrances.
Wait, oh yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman. Wait, wait, hey, 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 Mr. Postman.
Hey, Mr. Postman, look and see.
Oh yeah.
You've got a letter in your
please, please, Mr. Postman.
Oh, 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 somebody
oh, oh, yeah.
There's a letter from the portrait of man.
There must be some word today, yeah, from my boyfriend.
The Marvelettes, please, Mr. Postman, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This month, the Justice Department plans to recruit 1 million Americans in 10 pilot cities to act as citizen spies. A couple weeks ago, the Justice Department announced its new plan for the so-called War on Terror, Operation TIPS, the Terrorism Information and Prevention System. It aims to recruit millions of workers with access to private homes like FedEx delivery people, mail carriers, and gas meter readers, as well as truck drivers, train conductors, and ship captains to report what they think is suspicious activity. Teamsters President James Hoffa announced publicly that Teamsters supported the plan and that 500,000 Teamsters truck drivers would be the eyes and ears of the Homeland Security Office. But the U.S. Postal Service immediately issued a statement saying its 300,000-some postal workers had not signed on. Well, the online magazine Salon.com has just discovered that the Department of Justice is forwarding incoming Operation TIPS calls to the Fox-owned America's Most Wanted television series. We're joined right now by William Smith, who is president of the New York Metro Postal Workers Union. Welcome to Democracy Now!
I'm glad to be here.
Your reaction to the announcement that you and the people in your union, the mail carriers, would be the nation's spies?
Well, I'm going to correct you. We're not mail carriers I represent. I represent the people that process the mail in Manhattan, in the Bronx, and to Pasilta, New Jersey. We have the largest processing workers in the postal system, which is approximately about 500,000 people. I do not represent 500,000. That's nationwide. APW is, and Bill Burrows is the president, national president of the mail processing drivers and maintenance employees. I've represented about 10,000 right here, Manhattan and the Bronx and two facilities in New Jersey. My position is very clear. We believe that workers is hired to process mail. Workers is paid to process mail, not to be law enforcement agency or work in a capacity of law enforcement agency. It is clear that the postal worker has been used through this whole ordeal as guinea pigs, experiments. I'm opposed to any worker that get involved in Operation Tips based on the fact that they do not know the climate or the actual operation, what Operation Tips is all about.
And so how have mail carriers and those who process mail made their views known to the Justice Department?
Well, I can't speak for mail carriers because they are represented by another local right here in the city. But no one have ever approached me and asked me my opinion of this matter. But if any workers have, I would tell them they should not get involved. Now, if there's a suspicious package or a letter, quite natural, workers is not going to process that. They will automatically call management and tell them they do not want to work on this parcel or this letter if they see some white powder or forms around it. That to be expected. But in talking about getting involved and being spies for the law enforcement agency, I don't think workers involved should be involved with that kind of activity. It's just as simple.
Well, the people who process mail have been involved in a lot recently, right, under a lot of pressure. You have first, well, the TIPS program. You then have what happened with the anthrax letters. In an op-ed piece recently in the New York Times by Nicholas Kristof, he's talking about, well, it's pretty clear he's giving a profile of a man who later has become named as Stephen Hatfill. He is a top secret government, was a scientist at U.S. AMRID, involved with biological weapons research, who got his training in Zimbabwe, actually Rhodesia at the time of the greatest anthrax outbreak that affected 10,000 black Rhodesians, Zimbabweans, went to South Africa where there's a well-known biological weapons program under apartheid, came to the United States, worked there, has had his home raided, but still he has not been arrested. In this article, it sort of profiles him, asks how he got involved with secret weapons, biological weapons research, but also said, astonishingly, the FBI allowed the destruction of anthrax stocks at Iowa State University, losing what might have been valuable genetic clues. Then it waited until December to open the intact anthrax envelope it found. The FBI didn't obtain anthrax strains from various labs for comparison until March, and the testing is still not complete. The Bureau did not systematically polygraph scientists at two suspect labs, Fort Detrick, Maryland, and Dugway Proving Ground in Utah, until a month ago. And it talks about the incompetent investigation of the FBI when it came to anthrax. What are the mail processors? What is the process you've gone through since the beginning of this anthrax scare? And the fact that how many mail processors have died? Was it two in the Washington area?
Two, yes. Well, first of all, to the listening audience, I want them to understand this whole process. I do believe that the FBI knew all along that this was a domestic problem, not an international problem. And they knew that it was involved in any kind of terrorist attack. But it's clear, from my point of view, that the people involved doing this saw the need to go forward, to use this kind of September 11th crisis to go forward and try to get a tack through the system, mail system, to affect the American people's minds so they can be acceptable to saying that this is possible to be happening. And what I mean about that, listen, the audience need to understand, BAPO, who make a vaccine, okay, and they saw the need to come forward and offer a vaccine to the postal workers that they didn't see the need to test them and see was they were affected by the bacteria. So it's a lot of things taking place involving this whole crisis. And I would say to the American people and to postal workers that Congress, the Senate, the highest power in this land is the president, have simply done nothing for postal workers. Because it's obvious that it's a cover-up involved here. If they know who put this bacteria in the mail system, then it should have been arrested a long time ago. If they have idea who did it, then they should legally move on them. But they have not done so. So it's obvious that someone is covering up something here. And my question has always been to the press, to the media, they should dig and see who is Biport. What they stand to gain by getting the legalized drug vaccine legalized. What they stand to gain? Billions and billions of dollars on this crisis. And that's what it's about, money.
So how are you protecting yourselves right now?
Well, the only thing we can do is tell workers, work safe. If they see a suspicious pockets or a letter, do not process the mail. Do not touch a parcel that looks suspicious. In terms of, we are fighting to make sure that the buildings that we know have tested positive be retested and make sure the building is clean, the same way they did the Hart building. But you know the crisis on that. The judge ruled that the Postal Service, that the federal court do not have jurisdiction to demand that the Postal Service test any building that tested positive. Now, you know that's outrage. What law did they use to close the Hart building? The listening audience asked that question. They used the same law they closed the Hart building should apply to postal workers. And when it comes to postal workers, that law do not affect or do not have any kind of coverage over postal workers, only the judicial branch of government.
What are you demanding now?
Well, in one reason, it's racism. Let's be realistic. It's a large percentage of postal workers are minorities. In the Batu facility, in the facilities in Washington, D.C., and the largest mail, one of the largest mail processing facility right in the city of New York, is majority of minorities. And they don't see the need to protect the minorities as they see other branches of government, such as the president, the Congress, the Senate, and the Supreme Court Justice. It's clear on there. It should be clear to everyone about this crisis. And I can go into more specific. In Washington, D.C., you had two employees die. They was black. The Postal Service see the need now to tell the American people they want to raise a 45-cent stamp for the victim of the World Trade Center. Now, we're not opposed to that, but they have not raised one dime for those two black employees that died, family, in Washington, D.C. And they listen, or they need to understand that. And they need to write letters to our congressmen. They need to write letters to our senators. And they listen letters to the president. What is going on here? It is clear racism is involved, along with capitalism, which is because, you know, the mail process in Morgan, it processes almost 3 million pieces of mail a day. It's economic also. But also, racism has a big play in that decision, where they're going to retest Morgan and do what they have to do to make sure the building is safe to work in.
Morgan being the main mail processing place in Manhattan.
One of the largest in
this
country.
One of the largest. Will, I want to thank you very much for joining us. The latest on the anthrax information in terms of the investigation, the name Stephen Hatfill has surfaced. His home has been investigated several times. They went back to his home because supposedly the dogs went crazy there when they were brought in, meaning that they smelled something. A State Department official revealed last Thursday that Stephen Hatfill, the infectious disease specialist who's worked both in and for the government for nearly two decades, is on standby roster of experts waiting to go to Iraq with the UN weapons inspection team if President Saddam Hussein approves. although the U.S. government nominated most of the Americans serving with the U.N. Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission, Hatfill was one of the very few that applied independently. The spokesperson for UNMOVIC said Hatfill is one of some 230 trainees since 2000 that attended a U.N. training course, including a month-long course in France that dealt with issues of Security Council resolutions, cultural sensitivity, and exercises in occupational safety. According to CNN, Hatfill drew attention because in 1999, while working for a defense contractor, he commissioned a study that laid out a fictional scenario about terrorists sending anthrax through the mail. Well, we'll continue to follow that story and encourage people to go to our website at democracynow.org. We did an hour on Dr. Stephen Hatfill and his background. William Smith, president of the New York Metro Postal Workers Union, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, a debate on what's being called the Hollywood Hacking Bill that gives corporations the right to hack into personal computer networks. Stay with us.
C is for conclusion. That's good enough for me.
Guess what?
Copyright infringement in the kitchen. Copyright infringement by the new refrigerator. Copyright infringement. Right over by my club soda bottle.
Copyright infringement inside the club soda bottle.
Back out again. I'm back. What else?
Guess what?
Hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now, when you, in order that I can play this back, I have to pick up the phone because the cassette deck is the amplifier that I'm sending the phone on, so bear with me.
So when you're recording, you can't hear me?
I'm recording now.
The ABCs of anarchism. Negative Land and Chumbawamba here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, we were just talking about spying sponsored by the government. Now there's a bill that involves corporate spying. Corporations may soon be given the right to hack into personal computer networks to protect copyrighted material. The major record and film companies hope to use this legislation to end online piracy, they say. But critics fear the House bill would severely compromise personal privacy. The bill expands police powers to eavesdrop over the internet or telephone without a court order. But not all hacking is equal before the eyes of the government. In early July, the House voted to increase the maximum sentence for other forms of hacking to life in prison. We're joined by a few people right now to talk about what's become known as the Hollywood Hacking Bill. We're going to start with the person who represents the Congressman Howard Berman, the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, who proposed the Peer-to-Peer Piracy Prevention Act. Alec French is with us in Washington. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Can you explain what this bill is all about?
Sure. I'd love the chance to, because I think that the press circulating on it is wildly inaccurate. The bill doesn't allow copyright owners to hack into people's computers. That's wrong. All it allows is copyright owners to stop the illegal distribution of their copyrighted works through publicly accessible peer-to-peer networks. That doesn't in any way raise...
What is meant by peer-to-peer network?
Sure. The easiest example, I guess, would be a Kazaa, a Morpheus, or a Nutella, which are essentially software programs freely available on the internet that allow anyone who wants them to download them and then trade files, including copyrighted works, with anyone else that has that software. And of course, all of them, as currently structured, are publicly accessible. Any one of the 60 million people who's downloaded the Morpheus software can trade software, music, movies, whatever, with the other 60 million people that have the Morpheus software. So in our mind, there's clearly no privacy concern here, because if you're making a software program on your computer publicly available and accessible to 60 million other people, you don't have an expectation of privacy in that file. You're sharing it with the world. If a copyright owner sees that file on your computer, just like 60 million other people see it, they should have a right to stop you from pirating that by sending it to other people or by downloading it from other people.
Declan McCullough, chief political correspondent for CNetsNews.com, for the last 4 years with Washington Bureau Chief, was the Washington Bureau Chief for Wired News. What is your problem with this?
I confess I think it's a technical problem here. And first, I wasn't able to hear a word that the fellow from Representative Berman's office said. I can hear you just fine. That said, I don't have a huge problem with the general idea of trying to find new ways for the studios to prevent piracy online. I think the general idea of the bill, that is to give studios technological tools, is a good and sound one. But some of the way the actual bill is worded seems to me to be a little broad and maybe a little ill-considered. For instance, it would let nearly unchecked electronic hacking or disruptions if copyright owners believe there is a, quote, reasonable basis to believe that piracy is taking place. And if your computer was damaged even during this hacking process or interference or disruption process, you would have to receive the permission of the U.S. Attorney General before filing a lawsuit. And a suit could be filed only if you actually lost at least $250 in real economic damages, and very few people outside of a business setting would probably qualify for that. And so my interpretation of the bill, at least, is that it's saying thou shalt not delete stuff in people's computers, but it's like telling a kid don't take cookies out of the cookie jar, but if you do, well, there aren't really any penalties. So even though it says you shouldn't delete stuff, the penalties for deleting stuff, if you're a copyright hacker, are pretty low.
Amy?
Yes, Alec French of Congressman Howard Berman's office.
If I could respond, I mean, Declan's just flat wrong, and I can only surmise he hasn't read the bill. Page 8, line 3 of the bill, section F2, clearly says any remedies that a consumer has under current law, they continue to have under the bill. It's explicit in the bill, so anyone who thinks otherwise hasn't read it. What Declan's referring to is another provision of the bill that creates additional liability for copyright owners. So a consumer that feels that a copyright owner has wrongly hacked into their computer has the full range of current remedies that they have under current law, plus an additional cause of action that they can bring against copyright owners if there's $250 worth of damage and the other things apply. Not only that, there's an additional cause of action that the Attorney General can bring against the copyright owners, first of all. Second of all, there's no reasonable basis standard in the bill. I don't know what Declan's talking about. A copyright owner is only allowed to block the unauthorized distribution of their own copyrighted work through a publicly accessible peer-to-peer network. There's no if and or but about reasonable basis. That's the only thing they're allowed to do, block the unauthorized distribution of their copyrighted work. If they have a reasonable basis or otherwise, that doesn't matter. That's not what the safe harbor says. So I just don't know how he can say that about the bill. It's clearly false.
Siva Vaidyanathan is also with us, a media studies scholar and cultural historian, author of Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity. Your response to Berman's bill.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. I have a few questions for Alec. I'm very confused. I think he's hung up on this verb hack, as to hack. It means a bunch of things to a bunch of different people. So I'm wondering, if I have a file on my computer and it has the title, Oops, I Did It Again, the Britney Spears song title, and it's offered in the folder that goes out on the Nutella network, what can Britney Spears record company do to my computer and to me if this bill's passed?
Well, okay, what you've described is a file that's titled Britney Spears and, you know, has the title of her song, but is it or isn't it her copyrighted work?
Yes.
That's the question. It is or it isn't?
Well, I'm wondering what the copyright holder would see, what the copyright holder would do if you spotted a file with that name.
Well, I think the bill is very clear. If it, in fact, was her copyrighted work, i.e. that file contained an MP3 or whatever other format of her music, the copyright owner could prevent you from distributing it to other people. If, on the other hand, it just happened to be titled Britney Spears and it happened to have that name, but the file was, I don't know, your own song you created, the copyright owner can't do anything under this bill. The bill only says that someone can thwart the unauthorized distribution of their copyrighted work.
Right, and what's the due process to figure out whether it's in fact their copyrighted work?
Well, due process, I guess I'm not quite clear what you think the due process
would
be.
The
what I know is the technologies exist that allow a copyright owner, and they're widely deployed, Ranger Online, Cyvalent, Vidius, use these technologies that scour the internet now for copyrighted works, and they basically match an algorithm of the work to files that are found places in the internet to see whether the two files match.
So you're saying there's no due process. There's no review of what's actually on my hard drive by any authority besides the alleged copyright holder. And by the way, those companies that scour, they aren't copyright holders.
Yeah, they're agents of copyright holders.
Right, but they're not copyright holders, so they don't actually have the legal authority to take court action, for instance. Remember when we actually had copyright in this country, when you had to go to court and prove to somebody that you controlled a copyright of a work, and you had to then have a hearing, and a judge would review your claim and review the defendant's claim, and then there would be some sort of a ruling, maybe, and there would be rules of evidence. This is the problem with this bill. This bill throws out due process, and it's part of a series of efforts on behalf of Hollywood to criminalize music fans, criminalize film fans, and attack consumer rights from beginning to end. In an effort to go after the bad guys, you've handcuffed the rest of us. And I think this is a shameful act that shifts all of the burden to private powers that have absolutely no accountability.
I think you're flat wrong, because what this bill does is creates a defense against a charge of hacking. So if a copyright owner goes and blocks the piracy of their work, and someone believes that they've been hacked, that something happened to them that under current law would be illegal, they sue.
Okay.
There's the court. They sue. The copyright owner is hauled into court. And the copyright owner has to try to raise this as a defense. They have to try to say, wait a minute, I didn't do anything illegal here. All I was doing was blocking the infringement of my work.
Right.
The court then has to say, due process, just like you wanted to know, wait a minute, was the copyright owner doing this very narrow thing, impairing the distribution of their copyrighted work? Oh, let's see. Is it their copyrighted work? Yes.
Ah.
Then they were allowed to do it. It's a defense. This isn't an affirmative right.
I understand.
This bill creates a small, limited safe harbor from liability when the only thing you're doing is impairing the distribution of your copyrighted work. If you make a mistake as a copyright owner, if you block something that isn't your copyrighted work,
right,
you have full liability. So this bill retains a huge incentive not to block things that aren't your copyrighted work. In fact, it creates additional liability on the copyright owner if what they do is to block something that isn't their copyrighted work.
Right, but it essentially allows, empowers, gives Congress's permission to go ahead and mess with people's computers in the privacy of their own home, regardless of any sort of externalities around there, any sort of gray areas in what's in the file, gray areas in terms of what's actually available. There's no sense. This is essentially giving copyright holders the power to create an injunction of their own through technological means.
Well, Alec French, let me ask this question. It sounds like what you're saying is you can move in first, you can deem guilt first, and then if someone has the resources to sue, and most people don't have the time or the money to do that, they can go to court after.
Well, first of all, that's what current law does. I mean, if someone hacks your computer and actually hacks you today, you have to sue them. I mean, that's where people are today.
But this is giving congressional mandate. This is a bill that allows for this.
No, it says that you have a safe harbor from liability, and I think it's very similar. In fact, it's identical to what property right holders do in a variety of other contexts. Satellite companies send electronic countermeasures all the time to fry the cards, and that's a little more invasive in my mind, of people who've got pirate signal cards. Software companies disable their computer programs if someone is violating the license terms. Car owners, car dealerships, will go and repossess a car when someone stops making payments. It's analogous to if you're a property owner, someone steals your property, then they hang it out on their front fence. You're allowed to go, break the clothes, reach across that fence, and grab your property back.
Declan McCullough.
I have a question. I can now hear everyone. Thank you. Obviously, I've read the bill. I've written extensively about it. I got a copy before it was even introduced and wrote about it then. I'm looking at the final version of the bill, and it says that a copyright holder or owner can do pretty much anything they want in terms of blocking, diverting, or otherwise impairing the unauthorized distribution, etc., of a copyrighted work. I'm wondering what that actually means in practice. In the Gnutella or Kazaa example, let's say that I'm hooked up to one of these peer-to-peer networks and I have an actual infringing file on my machine, and I'm distributing it, maybe knowingly, maybe unknowingly. What does this allow a copyright holder to do?
Well, if that question is directed at me, I mean,
yes.
Let's not be coy, first of all. People are knowingly and massively infringing copyrights on peer-to-peer network. So let's deal with the reality of what
goes
on.
That there's and
what that
hypothetical too.
Sure.
Maybe they know. Maybe they don't know. What does this allow a copyright holder to do?
There are a variety of technologies out there today, and ones that we hope now the market will be free to develop when the fear of liability is lifted. That copyright owners could use to essentially block you from trading that file. For instance,
I understand that, but how would it actually work in principle? Just help me out. What technology are we talking about?
Okay. Well, one technology would be for kind of back end spoofing, where actually you described a situation where you have a file on your computer and you're trying to share it with others. A copyright owner could use, in that case, for instance, first in line interdiction, where they would go in and request that file from you on the ports that you have specified you're going to share that file through, and while they're downloading that file from you through those ports, no one else can get it. Now, that's obviously not to say that you wouldn't be able to do other things. You'd still be able to email. You'd still be able to web browse,
but you wouldn't be able to share that file. I understand. Thank you for the explanation, but this is something a copyright owner could do under current law. Nobody's saying that a copyright owner can't actually connect to my computer if I have it publicly available and download a copy of a song I have out there. So this doesn't answer my question. What does this proposed law allow a copyright owner to do that they can't do right now?
Well, actually, you're wrong in that copyright owners and the companies that create these technologies believe that first-in-line interdiction may raise liability under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, under state denial of service statutes. They're not using that technology specifically because they feel they might have inadvertent liability under this variety of state statutes and federal statutes.
There's no federal statute that applies specifically to denial of service attacks. There's nothing, as far as I can tell, that says if I have, say, a newspaper article that I wrote and I go on to Kazaa or Napster, I'm just making this up, and type in my news article name or my name and I try to download it, there's nothing saying that I'm violating the law. I'm not violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, certainly. What law would I be violating? None. What additional powers does this give me?
You then, as a copyright owner, would certainly have your own view of what liability you'd have, but people are not using that very technology that I've described because of a fear of liability. What you're describing is a little bit different, is downloading one copy. What I'm describing is downloading that copy from you, doing it, slowing down the download from your port, essentially, and then using the other ports that you're making available for that download, then getting in line behind yourself. Now, obviously, hackers and people that run the networks are resourceful. If when they see this going on, they're going to engineer around it. They may also decide that they're going to try to institute lawsuits to block that activity.
Alec French, counsel to Congressmember Howard Berman, I want to thank you for being with us, as well as Declan McCullough, chief political correspondent for CNET, first online reporter to join the National Press Club. Since I gave Alec French the first word, Siva Vaidyanathan, I give you the last word.
Well, this bill is part of a series of efforts on behalf of Hollywood to make sure that users in general are handcuffed in what they can do with lawfully purchased material. And I think that there should be a widespread consumer uprising. In fact, I think there already is. I think everybody should write to Congressman Berman's office and express to them that we still believe in due process in this country, that we don't think that copyright holders should have this much power to mess with our private activities. It's also important to remember that Declan is a copyright holder. I'm a copyright holder. Everybody who writes an email is a copyright holder. Think of the license that we all have to step in and mess with other people's hard drives if this law is passed. It's very important that we not get hung up on these moral panics and talk about what's really going on in these industries. These industries are panicking because they're not able to survive in a free market. So they're asking for government intervention to prop them up and give them all sorts of amazingly powerful tools.
Siva Vaidyanathan is author of Copyrights and Wrongs, Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to find out about some surveillance photographs in Qatar of what looks like a U.S. base being built there. And then we'll find out about the latest report given to the U.S. government on why Saudi Arabia is an enemy. Stay with us.
Oh, yeah, oh, shalom, aleinu. Oh, yeah, oh, shalom, aleinu. Ve'al kolam. Salam. Aleinu ve'al kol ha'olam. Salam. Salam. Oh, yeah, oh, shalom, aleinu. Oh, yeah, oh, shalom, aleinu. Urevo shalom aleinu ve'al kolam salam aleinu ve'al kol ha'olam salam salam Urevo shalom aleinu Urevo shalom aleinu Urevo shalom aleinu ve'al kolam salam aleinu ve'al kol ha'olam Salam, salam. Odevo shalom aleinu. Odevo shalom aleinu. Odevo shalom aleinu. Ve'al kolam. Salam, aleinu ve'al kolam.
Shalom, salam. Sent to us from Durango, Colorado, here on Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. In just a minute, we're going to talk about the report that came out in the Washington Post yesterday, a briefing last month for a top Pentagon advisory panel that depicted Saudi Arabia as an enemy of the United States and a backer of terrorism. In recent months, the Saudis have said they would not provide the U.S. with the kind of support they did in the Gulf War if the Bush administration decides to launch a massive attack on Iraq. Saudi Arabia shares a large border with Iraq and was the main launching ground for the U.S. forces during the war. The U.S. has now begun shifting its operations to the Gulf state of Qatar. Well, that's Q-A-T-A-R, pronounced, I think, more correctly, Qatar. Satellite photos published yesterday in the New York Post show just how far U.S. preparations for war with Iraq have advanced. The images were taken by the commercial satellite company Digital Globe. Tim Brown joins us now. He's a senior analyst at GlobalSecurity.org, which is a defense think tank based in Alexandria, Virginia, an expert on satellite analysis. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you explain these photographs?
Yeah, basically, these were taken about a month ago. There are actually two sets. One set was taken from the Iconos satellite, which is a competitor to Digital Globe, back in January. And then we have a newer photo from Digital Globe, taken just about a month ago. And what it shows is that there's continued construction and expansion at this relatively brand new airbase that didn't exist 4 years ago.
And how did these? How were these pictures taken?
Well, they're taken from these are commercially operating satellites. They fly in a polar orbit, so they're going north to south about every 90 minutes, and they can cover the same part of the world at the equator about every 2.5-3 days, something like that. And so, depending on cloud cover and atmospheric, air, what kind of haze and such there is, and also competition from other people who want to order other imagery in that same path, it can take anywhere from a couple weeks to a couple months to get an image. But anyway, somebody ordered these. We didn't order them. Somebody else ordered them, and we found them on the archive, their online archive, and we requested them. And I think what's interesting about this base is that we have an earlier photo that was taken in 1995 from the Spot satellite, which is a French satellite. And this entire area is just desert. And then we have a photo taken last fall from Iconos, and you can see this airbase out of nowhere. And so basically somewhere in the last 5 years, the U.S. government started construction on this airbase, basically as a replacement to the their main operating base at Prince Sultan in Saudi Arabia.
In looking at these and the descriptions of them, it shows under construction hardened aircraft shelters that can hide hundreds of warplanes. And in recent months, a giant tent city that's been erected to house as many as 3,800 troops.
Yeah, this base, one of the things remarkable about it is that as far as aircraft is concerned, there's not really much to see. There are two very large underground hangars, so to speak, at each end of the airfield, and each of those can house probably a couple dozen aircraft apiece, small fighters. And instead of just having aircraft parked out in the open, like we used to do, or having an individual aircraft shelter for each one, they built these rather large hangars that are very large. They're hardened concrete, and they're painted to blend in with the color of the desert, so they're very low visibility. And so there's really nothing to see. You can't count, well, how many aircraft are stationed here. You can make a guess and you can surmise, but there's not you can't see, well, which ones are being worked on, which ones are down for maintenance. And so that, and also the fact that they're underground and protected, adds quite a bit to the safety and security of the aircraft.
Well, from Qatar, we now move to Saudi Arabia. Last night and this morning, the cable news networks were all abuzz with discussions of a report in yesterday's Washington Post. It detailed a briefing given last month to a top Pentagon advisory board describing Saudi Arabia as an enemy of the United States. It recommends that U.S. officials give Saudi Arabia an ultimatum to stop backing terrorism or face seizure of its oil fields and its financial assets invested in the United States. The briefing runs counter to the present stance of the U.S. government that Saudi Arabia is a major ally in the region. It also represents a point of view that has growing currency with the Bush administration, especially on the staff of Vice President Cheney and in the Pentagon civilian leadership and among neoconservative writers and thinkers closely allied with administration policymakers. The leaking of the details of the briefing sparked these remarks from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld.
Apparently what happened was the Defense Policy Board, which is made up of people who've worked in this department or have a great deal of knowledge or competence in government or the policy issues from the defense establishment. A number of my predecessors served on the Defense Policy Board, for example. They have a meeting every period of months, and they have briefings by people. And people come in, and this apparently was a person from the RAND Corporation who was giving a briefing. And he briefed on Saudi Arabia, and it ended up in the newspaper, which is unfortunate. It's harmful in this case, for example, because it creates a misimpression that someone then has to figure out a way to correct. But I don't know what the solution to it is. I think that something like that ending up out is kind of undoubtedly by somebody who wanted to make themselves feel important, that they knew what was going on and that therefore they would tell someone else. And it and no lives are lost. On the other hand, when classified information is released that could affect the lives of men and women in uniform, that could inhibit and make more difficult the task of the United States of America in tracking down terrorists, and in fact actively assist terrorists in figuring out what it is we're thinking and doing, I think it is criminal.
Donald Rumsfeld, War Secretary, saying in those last words that the release of this report, or the leaking of this report, is criminal. We're joined by Lami Sandoni, who is an independent journalist who writes frequently for Al Hayat and Aharam Weekly. Next year, teaching a course at UC Berkeley on the war on terrorism. She's covered the Gulf War from Baghdad for the Christian Science Monitor and the Financial Times. Your response to the report and to the board that it was reported to, the significance of this?
Well, I'm not surprised by the report, and I'm not surprised by either the report coming from the person it came from, and by the fact that it presented to that kind of a board.
Can you talk about both, who it came from and what the board is?
Yes. Laron Morovic, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. I only read his name often, but I don't know how to pronounce it. It's Muraweic. He's a RAND analyst, but a very well-known right-wing French thinker and analyst, who has taken upon himself for the last few years in defending the unilateral American dominance in the world, and has taken upon himself to attack all left-wing political thinkers in France. After September 11th, Mr. Laurent Morovic attacked the thinkers and analysts who pointed out to the U.S. involvement in mobilizing during the war in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union, the Islamic fundamentalists, and fueling the Wahhabi using the Wahhabi fundamentalism that's prevalent in Saudi Arabia, together with Saudi government, in an attempt to mobilize young Muslims to fight in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union. So he is also known for his anti-Islamic, anti-Arab views, and he doesn't even believe that there is a Palestinian question. He thinks that this is all a manufactured question. So I'm not surprised that he's the one that was invited, because his views correspond with many people on the board. This board is the Defense Policy Board has always been there. It's a sounding board for the Pentagon, but it has become more influential in this new administration, especially that most of the main people who are now in the Defense Department and in Cheney's office were members of the board. And I find Rumsfeld's statement cynical, because Rumsfeld himself gives a lot of importance to the board. He often attends their meetings and agree with them, and it's on the record that he attends the meetings and often gets his ideas from there and agrees with them.
Just to say that the Defense Policy Board is headed up by the former Pentagon official Richard Perle, one of the most prominent advocates in Washington of an invasion of Iraq. He is a media darling, constantly being interviewed about his views.
Exactly. Most of the board members and their allies or their other experts that they rely on, because there's the board and the experts other than Morovic that they rely on, like people from the Center for Security Analysis. Actually, this is a center that has not been in the news as a center, but most of the people who are now on the board or working in the government come from this center. This is Center of Security Analysis emerged or was formed in the mid-90s after the defeat of the Republicans and the ascension of power of the Democrats to power, and it became the base, the platform for all of the Chinese men, all of the former administration officials, the Bush administration officials, who were preparing themselves for leading what they called strategy for the 90s. And that strategy of the 90s, that its main component was to make sure that to prevent, that the U.S. has to prevent the emergence of a rival power, even if it had to use force, and it even recommended using force to prevent the emergence of the rival power.
Lama Sandoni, a question on the Saudi-U.S. relationship. With the new Bush administration, following a decade ago the old Bush administration, it's always believed that the Bush family, a kind of royal family in the United States, has been very close to the Saudi royal family. So this report comes as a surprise, talking about Saudi Arabia as an enemy, since the two families, it is believed, have been, quote, so close. Can you talk about Saudi Arabia and also the stories coming out in the media in the last week, possibility of Saudi Arabia teetering on the brink of collapse, this in The Observer from Britain a week ago, with, it said, fears of an extremist takeover of one of the West's key allies in the war on terror?
Well, this corresponds, and this is consistent with a campaign that aims to pressure Saudi Arabia to comply to what the U.S. wants. The U.S., as you know, Saudi Arabia has been reluctant to take part in an attack against Iraq and has reservations in about the different contingency plans that have been leaked to the press about attack and the change of regime in Iraq. And there's also the Saudi support for the Palestinians. I mean, it's not the Palestinians don't believe that Saudi Arabia is providing enough support, but the support is enough to have irritated the people in the administration. From my following of this issue, there are two lines inside the administration. One, and I think Bush is more inclined to this line, is to use this campaign to pressure the Saudi regime and remind the Saudi regime how reliant and dependent it is on American support, and hence for the reports that it's teetering on collapse and it will be taken over by extremists. So this is one. The other line, which is depicted in this report there that was presented to the Defense Board, and which echoes a lot of views, especially the most pro-Israeli views inside the administration, inside the Pentagon and Cheney's office, Cheney's team, is that Saudi Arabia can no longer be an ally. It's the era of you're with us or you're against us, and we cannot make any accommodation for Saudi Arabia at the expense of Israel.
But doesn't this run counter to the Bush-Saudi relationship?
I think that the Bush family thinks that such campaigns would only make the Saudi family more malleable. They will not lose their friendship with the Saudi family. This is what the Bush family, I think, thinks.
Yeah, we're looking at the Qatar pictures of a new airbase being built, presumably because they're concerned that they won't be able to do it from Saudi Arabia, launch an attack on Iraq.
Yes, there are two things that we have to remember now.
We only have 10 seconds.
Yes. First of all, that the Bush family is an oil family. And it might be, we should investigate if it's looking now to the Caspian Sea and other sources of oil as an alternative for money-making.
5 seconds.
Saudi Arabia. Secondly, Qatar has less at stake than Saudi Arabia in accepting such a role.
Lama Sandoni, I want to thank you very much for being with us. That does it for the program Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Jeremy Scahill, Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro, is recuperating. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.